Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter.
A warm welcome to our listeners, and thank you for tuning in. Today, or at least the day that this podcast goes live, is November 6th. November 6th is UN Day for Preventing the Exploitation of the Environment in War. And our regular listeners will remember that we've discussed the impacts of armed conflict on the environment on the podcast already on a few occasions. We looked at how war impacts the environment and livelihoods in Syria in June last year. And we also looked at it from the international environmental aspect and the weaponization of the environment in Ukraine in October last year, so about a year ago.
We've put this podcast episode together in collaboration with PAX, which is the largest peace organization in the Netherlands and is working to protect civilians against actors of war, to end armed violence, and to build inclusive peace. We're looking forward to looking at prevention and taking a deep dive into the outstanding policy and legal gaps for adequate protection of the environment in armed conflicts, recommendations for states and the international community on steps ahead and the legal side of things. So without further delay, we'd like to welcome our guest for this episode, Wim Sveinaburg, a humanitarian disarmament project leader at PAX, and Helen Obergon, legal advisor at the International Committee of the Red Cross. Welcome to you both.
Yes, welcome from my side as
well. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So let's get started with Wim. So Wim, when it comes to assessing the devastation of war, we often see that casualties, they will be counted in terms of those who have been killed and wounded, destruction of cities, destruction of livelihoods. So we look at the human dimension first, of course, and then at infrastructure and at economy at some point. But environmental impacts, they are rarely part of the conversation. And there's so much there. We're talking contaminated groundwater, destroyed crops, deforestation, poisoned soils, poisoned air. And even on the more strategic side of things, for example, livestock that is being deliberately killed for gaining military advantage. And this is just to name a few, of course. Can you start us off with a few examples that demonstrate this?
Yeah, sure. And thanks again for having us on your podcast. And I think it's a very good question. The often heard phrase is that the environment is sort of invisible victim of conflict. But over the last couple of decades, we've seen much more visibility on what's actually happening in terms of environmental consequences of conflict. And apart from the war, can have like direct and far-reaching environmental consequences. But also each conflict brings unique challenges, and they're all depending on the geography of the country, the economic system that the country is thriving on. So for example, you can think of bombing of factories and power plants, water treatment facilities, and the millions of rounds of unexploded remnants of war that are contaminating agricultural lands and forests, but also like degraded water resources and collapse of waste management. Now, take for example Ukraine. It's a very heavy industrialized country with thousands of small and larger enterprises that are producing and storing large volumes of hazardous substances that pose direct health risks for civilians, but also can have severe impacts on ecosystems if they're being bombed. So hundreds of these facilities have been damaged or destroyed already after Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. And the estimated cost of these environmental damages in Ukraine is already in the billions of dollars, according to numbers released by the Ukrainian government. And over the last 1.5 year, has been monitoring like all these specific kind of damages in Ukraine. So we've seen large-scale destruction of power plants that are in itself containing, for example, of PCBs, which are heavy chemicals, but also they're providing electricity to facilities that are needing them to facilitate people's livelihoods or factories. And we've seen damage to agro-industrial facilities. So the east of Ukraine is a very agriculture-rich area, so they produce a lot of fertilizers. And they use a lot of pesticides and herbicides, and all these storage facilities or production facilities are shelled and bombed, so creating some kind of localized pollution hotspots. but also the war itself, there has been direct targeting of oil refineries, oil depots all over the country, which resulting in localized soil and water pollution. We've seen oil pollution in the Black Sea from attacks on gas drilling platforms. But you can also look at, for example, issues around facilities that are household production facilities near industrial areas, which we also seen in some of the cores of the larger cities such as Kyiv and Kharkiv and Chernihiv. And these are also more in populated areas itself, so where civilians are living. So these are all acute risks from chemicals and hazardous substances. But in other countries, such for example, Syria and Iraq, we've seen the far-ranging environmental destruction. In Syria, we've used remote sensing to track what's happening in the 12 years of war, where Syria lost nearly half of its forest caused by illegal logging, as people are desperately looking for fuel. Armed groups and government forces have deliberately destructed, for example, commercial orchards, as we saw in the green belt around Aleppo and Damascus and Palmyra. And armed groups are logging forests to profit from, as we've seen in northern Aleppo, where armed groups have been involved in that. And as a last example, in Iraq, we've seen both Syria and Iraq are really dependent on water from the Tigris and Euphrates River. And they're currently facing the compounding impact of war and climate change. In Iraq, decades of war and internal conflicts resulted in damage to water infrastructure, governance, both leading to a decline in water quality from lack of repairs in post-conflict phase, illegal dumping of industrial waste because no one's checking anymore, and there are trans-boundary water problems, as Turkey and Iran are retaining more water in dams because of both for economic reasons but also for climate impact, which makes rainfall more erratic, and that's having an impact on people downstream in Iraq and Syria, and thereby worsening public health livelihoods for communities that are depending on that, but also unique ecosystems that we've seen in southern Iraq as well in the marshes area. And some of these impacts are really catastrophic for the future of these kind of communities. And these are just two examples looking at larger industrial sites, but also different kind of geographies such as in the Middle East and numerous other examples from Yemen or South Sudan or Libya that are facing similar issues. And in between, there's a range of environmental topics that we're currently doing research on, but yeah, that shows the breadth and intensity of the environmental destruction from wars.
Thanks, Vim. Before we dive into guidelines and some of the legal aspects, Helen, could you also say a few words about what ICR sees and why you also work on this topic?
Sure. And first of all, thank you so much, Raquel and Alexandra, for having me here. It's really a pleasure. I think following from Wim and hearing about sort of the environmental consequences of wars, the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, I mean, what we do and part of our core mandate is really to work on alleviating the suffering of victims of armed conflict. And increasingly, we see how the protection of the environment is really inseparable from the protection of civilians and their protection in both the short and the long term. So, of course, environmental consequences have severe, complex consequences for civilians, and these often persist over the long term, even after wars have ended. And today, there's an additional factor that we are seeing in our operations, and that is, of course, climate change, which adds urgency to the topic. Issues like water scarcity, desertification, and land degradation are more pressing in contexts like Yemen, Iraq, and Niger that are already affected by armed conflicts and the effects of environmental degradation. So we really see how climate change exacerbates already existing environmental degradation and the environmental degradation we see in war. And this really compounds the risks that local populations that are facing conflict experience. And so this is really why, in the face of the environment becoming and being even more important in war contexts where the ICRC works, we have been looking at strengthening its protection in armed conflict. Thanks.
Thanks. So now let's dive a little bit into the law, and in this case, international humanitarian law, as a tool to protect the environment. And as you've mentioned, of course, civilians who rely on it. And in 2020, ICRC published updated guidelines on the protection of the natural environment in armed conflict. And this sets out rules and recommendations relating to the protection of the natural environment under international humanitarian law. And so there's 32 of these guidelines. So of course, hopefully you can provide kind of a short overview, but we'll link the details in the podcast description. So can you elaborate on these guidelines and why these updates were needed to be made? And what are the main novelties here?
Sure. The guidelines are really the concerted ICRC effort to try to put into one document the rules of international humanitarian law, or also known as the law of armed conflict, that provide protection to the environment in war. And so we like to say that they're sort of a one-stop shop on relevant IHL on the environment. So the guidelines cover sort of four broad sets of rules in IHL. They look at, for example, rules that provide very specific protection to the environment, but also more general protection, rules on weapons, and then also rules that are all about making sure that these obligations under IHL are implemented, promoted, and actually put in practice. So for example, in the guidelines, one of the rules that is covered is the prohibition for states and non-state armed groups that are parties to armed conflict from attacking the environment unless it becomes a military objective. Parties are also prohibited from attacks that cause disproportionate damage to the environment. And for example, pillage of the natural environment is also prohibited. So these are only three of the 32 rules that the guidelines address. And really what we have in the guidelines is the IHL rules that are a basis to prevent environmental damage in armed conflicts, and also that can be looked at for accountability for violations of this body of law. But really the purpose of the guidelines is to serve as a reference for parties to armed conflict in particular, but also for other actors that are working on the promotion, the implementation, and the application of IHL. And the aim is really to help these actors and parties to armed conflict to adopt concrete measures on IHL protecting the environment so that they can apply these rules and improve military practices. Why were they updated and why are they an update rather? So the background of the guidelines is that they had a first version in 1994 that the ICRC produced in response to a request from the United Nations General Assembly in the wake of the devastating environmental consequences that were seen in the 1990-1991 Gulf War. And so the reason we took those guidelines from 1994 and brought them forward is for some of the reasons I mentioned before. So the effects of armed conflict on the environment and the consequences we see on people. But really, it was about sort of reflecting developments in international treaty and customary law that have happened since 1994, which, as you can imagine, is there are quite a lot of developments. So one of the novelties of the 2020 guidelines is that they are more detailed in scope than the 1994 one. So they take the content of the previous iteration and it remains valid, but these guidelines now have a commentary that provides additional detail on each rule and recommendation so that it's essentially to aid understanding and application of these rules in practice. Another key novelty is that while the 1994 guidelines were primarily directed at armed forces of a state, the 2020 guidelines really try to look at and be a resource for all parties to armed conflict, including non-state armed groups. And an important aspect of this is that the majority of IHL obligations that are contained in the guidelines bind non-state armed groups in addition to states. And so this is why we really wanted to sort of also emphasize this aspect in the guidelines.
Yeah, thanks for outlining some of the need behind this and also how the guidelines have changed over time and how they've increased in this understanding and application in practice. So let's stay on this note for a little bit. And maybe Vim, if you could share some examples from Iraq and how these environmental protection efforts have changed since the Gulf Wars, which helped serve as a catalyst for the guidelines creations in the first place, and how they can be implemented and how they're being used now given the fighting in northern and western Iraq.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. The 1991 Gulf War, and everyone knows these images of these burning oil wells in Kuwait, which also led to Kuwait later on putting forward the UN General Resolution, and also in the end, the establishment of the November 6th day as a reminder of the environmental destruction of war. But in particular, in the last 6-7 years, the war in Iraq and the fight against the so-called Islamic States, we've seen how it left environmental scars. ISIS blew up oil wells again that kept burning for months. There was severe damage to urban areas from the use of explosive weapons that can have reverberating environmental effects. And by documenting the widespread nature of environmental damage and raising this, for example, during negotiations over a UN Environment Assembly resolution in 2017, funding became available for cleanup and remediation efforts. And these strong visuals of these burning oil wells in Gayara in Iraq in 2016 were also a stark reminder of the environmental impact of war on civilians and tens of thousands of people displaced that were living downstream from these burning wells and living under the black skies from the smoke. And as Helen said as well, we're much better in a much better position to make this link between protection of civilians and protection of the environment, because we've seen how environmental destruction has like acute effects on, or can have acute effects on, people and ecosystems, and both in terms of health effects, but also their ability to return later on in a post-conflict phase and restart their lives. And the increased research and media attention also helped raising the profile of protection of the environment in armed conflict, and was also instrumental for us in engaging with states to step up efforts on both legal and policy norms on this protection. Both we're working through multilateral forums where we engage with states on this, such as the UN Environment Assembly, which I mentioned earlier, which had several resolutions on the linkages between environmental protection in conflict in 2015, 2016. And there are other linkages in resolutions. The UN Security Council, in particular in their discussions around protection of civilians, have now reiterated the linkages between protection of civilians and protection of the environment. And there are more sub-discussions in the Human Rights Council on, for example, conflict pollution and toxics, their right to a clean environment, their responsibilities for states and businesses in conflict-affected areas. And of course, discussions in the UN General Assembly, where the International Law Committees had their draft principles on protection of the environment accepted after a decade-long process to establish these legal principles on protection of the environment. And lastly, in the humanitarian response community, we also see the need to include environmental dimensions of conflict in their research work, and it became much more accepted to include environmental considerations in for humanitarian organizations if they're active in conflict or post-conflict areas, to have data on, is there anything particular here that's in terms of information that's helpful for them? If there's any contaminated water sources from bombings, or how to set up displacement camps in areas without a large environmental footprint, and having better data on the environmental impacts of the war and the more broader, for example, climate related problems they may run into as well, helps them more anticipate and mitigate these risks. And at the same time, they're also doing research in these areas as well, and their research on what the environmental impacts are is also helpful to close the circle back, to push these policy debates and engage with states and militaries on strengthening and improving environmental protection in their operations, or to ensure that funding is available in post-conflict phase for cleanup and remediation. And there has been a long trajectory of progress over the last decade that has been made, and we're really looking forward to engage better with states on how to make it even better than to minimize and mitigate those environmental harmful effects of conflict.
I think what I find most impressive about the advancement of this discussion is that one would never think that the environment matters for a state that is waging war or that is being victimized by war and conflict, but it does seem to matter for most parties out there. So even if you can't address it immediately in the post-conflict context, it does seem to be a topic that states are willing to talk about and address, even when they are conflict parties themselves. And I find that interesting, to say the least. Definitely more than interesting, but just to say the least. Helen, I wanted to ask you a question, because in addition to the ICRC guidelines, you had also last year the UN International Law Commission adopting the PIRAC, the Principles on the Protection of the Environment in Relation to Armed Conflicts, which were welcomed by the General Assembly. But of course, the implementation of both the PIRAC principles and the ICRC guidelines, they will depend on the states themselves, which are often conflict parties, or also on, as you were saying, on groups who are not implementing parties at all, such as the case you mentioned in the beginning with non-state armed groups engaging in environmental damage. And just as a side note, I think that the inclusion of these groups and the accountability for the environmental impacts of conflict, it does come to show how the conflict dynamics are changing, but also how much the international community is kind of working to catch up with this changing landscape. It's a complicated situation, but I wanted to know from you how you would describe the current state of play in the international policy arena within these legal efforts to better protect the environment in conflict. It's a very general question, so let's see what you come up with.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's a very good question. And maybe just to bounce from what Wim was saying, because it's sort of the closing of the guidelines and looking a bit more also at the other things that are around. I think 3 decades of advancements in environmental science that Wim was just talking about is really one of the things also that the ICRC guidelines are urging parties to take into account these developments, what we know about the impacts of armed conflict on the environment, what we know about the relationship between ecological and human health. So all of these things that Wim just talked about and the technological advances and data that we have are really things that we think are key to leverage to better implement the legal framework that I also want to talk about a bit more now. So together with all of these technological scientific advances in the last decade, there has also been an increasing momentum in the international legal community to ensure the protection of the environment. And Wim talked about some of the UN resolutions and discussions that have started to reflect much more sort of this urgency to address the environmental impacts of war. Most historically, you mentioned the adoption, of course, of the International Law Commission's PEREC principles. And here, I really think that emphasizing the historic nature of this contribution is really key, because what the International Law Commission principles do is that they seek to clarify and develop the international legal normative framework on environmental protection before, during, and after war. And while the ICRC guidelines focus on humanitarian law, the PEREC principles are broader in scope. So they also look at international environmental law, at human rights law. And this is really important because in armed conflicts, the effects that we see on the environment are not all addressed by IHL, so by humanitarian law. There are many that are, and IHL and the rules that I was mentioning in the guidelines is key to addressing these. But for other kinds of impact, for instance, the carbon footprint of war, other bodies of law have to be looked at as well. And so that's where the broader scope of the ILC's work is really complementary to the ICRC's work on international humanitarian law. And in addition, the ICRC guidelines, the ILC principles also reflect that the IHL principles and rules on distinction, proportionality, and precautions apply to the natural environment. And this is really key. It shows once again the complementarity between the work. And then the ICRC guidelines sort of provide more detail on how IHL applies to the environment. And ultimately, the ILC principles and the ICRC guidelines reinforce each other's objectives. So really, the aim is to set out existing law and in order to urge parties to armed conflict to put these into practice. So I think the current state of play where we are today, I think it is clear that there is quite significant law out there that has the potential to better restrain the impact of military operations on the environment. But this is the paper story. So what we need today is to move from norm setting really to operationalization. So to looking at how we can actually implement and put these rules into practice. So you rightly noted, Raquel, that for this, we need states and we need parties to armed conflict. And we know, of course, that the law is violated too often. But I think an important point here is that we see in the rules on speed limits, the fact that the law is sometimes not respected doesn't mean that it isn't actually imposing changes in behavior and saving lives in addition to that. So I think what we need really today is to make environmental protection more understood and more of a reflex among warring parties, mindful of the obligations that they have to minimize environmental damage as they fight. So really, it's about taking the rules that we have and so that they are actually effective in practice, making sure that they find their ways into national laws, military manuals, training of armed forces, but into the consciousness of armed forces and parties to armed conflict as they fight.
Super interesting aspect. I like your analogy. It's not about this black and white. I mean, we know that this perfect condition in which the environment is simply not touched during a conflict, we know that this is utopic and that's not necessarily what we're talking about. And it doesn't mean that it has to undermine the entire body of law. So I like that very much, particularly the part in internalizing these principles to make them more clear and maybe to be in the back of the minds of actors who are perhaps able to act on avoiding impact, but just don't do because it's not a topic, right? Environment is not a topic currently, but we're working to make that a thing. So Wim, now to you, coming from the more practical side of things, what do you think are outstanding gaps, both legally and from a policy perspective? So thinking of what kind of efforts would need to complement the ICRC guidelines and the Prague principles to make protection possible. And also, I think it's a question that everyone wants to know, have these legal developments at some point already made it possible to prevent environmental damage and exploitation in war today that we know of?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question because we've now addressing this from different angles. So we have the work done by the IOC, there's the very important work that Helen has been working on with her colleagues on improving or working on the military guidelines to engage with militaries and really put it on their radar on the responsibilities in terms of prevention and mitigation of environmental damage. But yeah, it's a widespread subject that can be approached from different angles, but there's no sort of overarching umbrella of a policy umbrella that helps like going through the whole cycle of conflicts before, during, after, how to work on prevention, for example, through shared natural resources, which can also be a source for conflicts during an armed conflict, how to mitigate environmental effects and after armed conflict that you're dealing with remediation and cleanup in order to protect civilians and communities and ecosystems. And that's why we're sort of trying to work on a wider environment, peace and security agenda that brings in all the different aspects. So in our conversations with states, we work in all these different forums, the General Assembly, the Security Council, the Environment Assembly. So that's in Nairobi, Geneva, New York. But often we've come across that states or different departments have no idea what's happening in another forum on this particular topic. So all these issues are not really connected. So that's why it's very helpful if there's a more coherent approach in all these different forums that are dealing with different issues, but they have the environment as a sort of connecting factor in the policy and response work to the environmental impacts of conflict. So what actually now is needed is some sort of this overarching agenda, environment, peace, and security, and then a robust mechanism in response to conflict damage. At the moment, it's a sort of hazard approach where some states have funding available to respond to conflict damage. We've seen in Ukraine, there's millions and millions of euros going into addressing the environmental impacts of war. But in Syria or Iraq or Yemen, it's really limited, let alone forgotten conflicts such as the DRC or in Ethiopia, because there's no funding available because there's less interest from states. And I think that's one of the gaps we're still having, that we shouldn't be just addressing this because it's important to a few neighboring states or that people have a political interest in this particular region, but we have to be consistent and addressing that everywhere where it's possible. That also has to do with mandates from, for example, the UN Environment Program, which is the most dedicated UN program or organization to work on this, but they're bounded by limited operational procedures to actually address it, or either a limited funding. And yeah, so having a good implementation mechanism, a structural funds to deal with this would be helpful. And for us, it's also then work, see if there's possibility to work towards more accountability. So as PACs, we also feel like states are responsible for, in particular, if there's widespread long-term damage to the environment in terms of cleanup and remediation, because if we don't do that, and it's often missing in post-conflict response, those have direct impacts for civilians, but also in the long-term limits reconstruction efforts and the ability for people to move on with their lives. And if that's being forgotten, that can also pose new risks for conflicts or displacement as well. So yeah, what there is needs to be implemented. There needs to be dedicated financial resources and expertise to do that, and needs to be a more structural overarching approach throughout the UN system to establish a UN-wide environment, peace, and security agenda.
Perfect. You've already kind of rightfully steered us towards one of our kind of wrap-up questions as we're starting to near the end of our conversation today. And you've rightfully outlined some of these things that we need, from enforcement mechanisms, overarching agenda, these structural funds, and more mandates and a focus on environment, peace, and security. So for our audience, we've already kind of outlined the history of these guidelines, principles, how they've developed from these kind of overarching guidelines to something that can work in specific contexts, things that are easier to take up, and moving really from norm saving and hopefully in the future to operationalization. And so maybe we can look to the future and what are our concrete next steps, not too far in the future. And maybe then, Helen, you can start us off and kind of wrap things up. What are future opportunities to actually strengthen these norms and principles that our audience should consider, and what should they look out for?
Thanks a lot. Actually, it's not so futuristic. So really, as I was saying, I think the key really here is to increase and work more on strengthening the implementation and compliance with the rules that we have. So with the PEREC principles, we really have an opportunity that can't be missed to galvanize law and policy change in domestic frameworks. And at the ICRC, when looking at international humanitarian law more specifically, we are essentially putting forward four key recommendations for states and parties to armed conflict to enhance respect for IHL rules relating to the environment's protection. And these are really some of the areas on which we would like to see change in the coming years so that we can minimize the environmental impacts of war. So for example, first, states and parties to armed conflict have to work more to integrate the IHL guidelines into their military manuals, into their training, but also more broadly into national legal and policy frameworks. A second aspect, and this really connects also to Wim's work and what he was saying about assessing the effects of environmental damage, is precisely this. So we are encouraging parties to armed conflict to really assess what impacts they see of their military operations on the environment so that they can use this information to minimize these impacts. A third recommendation that we've been making and also exploring further is how states can identify and designate areas that are of particular environmental importance or fragility as demilitarized zones or otherwise protected, to essentially put them off limits to military operations. And finally, and this is a more general one, and it's sort of a key aspect, is continuing to exchange good practices on ways that states can better comply with their obligations to protect the environment. And the good news is that there is a wealth of good practices that is already out there. The ICRC, together with Switzerland, organized a state expert meeting on IHL and the protection of the environment in early 2023. And the aim of this was precisely to hear from states on the challenges they have to improve the protection of the environment, but also good practices that they have already taken or that they could consider taking to enhance environmental wartime protection. And some of the concrete examples that were mentioned during that meeting, for example, we heard that some militaries have established staff or units within their armed forces that have specific environmental expertise and responsibilities so that they can reduce the impacts of military operations on the environment. We also heard how commanders and their units during the planning of operations consult maps on some of these particularly fragile environmental areas. And lastly, we also heard examples of military personnel consulting and seeking advice from environmental experts when possible, and supplementing, and here I go back to what Wim has also talked about, supplementing this information with remote or open source data on the types of damage that we see. So these and other examples of good practice that is out there or that can be built on can be found in the chair summary of this meeting, which is also available online. And really the idea and what we need now is to sort of take these examples of good practices, make them more widely understood, and then implemented across all states, not just a few. And this is really, I mean, just as a closing kind of thought and going back to the beginning of our conversation, and key today, we depend on the environment for our survival. We know it, and we know the extent to which this is true. So states really can and must take steps to integrate these legal protections into their policies and practices so that we can limit the environmental impacts of war and the consequences for people.
Thanks so much. Any final closing thoughts from your side, Vim?
Yeah, I think we do see indeed there is movement forwards. It's very rewarding, or not rewarding, it's very promising to see that there are now these initiatives moving forward. For example, Geneva Water Hub is currently working on to get an alliance on working on protection of water infrastructure in conflicts, and we see states supporting that. And the work that Helen mentioned as well, like, can we work towards more improvement of nature areas? So it's a gradual, slow approach where we take one piece by another. And at the same time, we also have to recognize some gains that have been made. So to look at, for example, this year, a lot of states invested millions and millions of dollars into preventing an environmental catastrophe at the coast of Yemen from the FSO Safar, a major oil tanker, which was abandoned in 2015, and it was at the coast of Yemen and was at risk of sinking, creating a region-wide impact in both humanitarian and environmental. And so you saw states recognizing this also in their statements and dedicate funding to prevent this from happening. And on the smaller level as well, we also work in Yemen to get funding to clean up for a number of smaller tankers which were abandoned in the port of Aden. And funding went there to do a cleanup and remediation and removal of those ships. So these are small wins and victories, and we're far from there yet in terms of preventing this. Like, wars will always be environmentally destructive, unfortunately. So ideally, we work towards preventing wars in general. But I think the recognition of this, the recognition from states that there is indeed this impact of war on the environment and people depending on it, is a major win. Seeing this being incorporated in humanitarian response is a major gain. And maybe we could be more ambitious. And also, I'm saying this from a more campaign kind of mode, but I think also from a non-governmental side, from civil society who have been working on this and also working with partners in conflict-affected areas, we can be more ambitious in terms of highlighting these risks. I think the accountability is an important one here. We've seen several heads of states already referring to or calling for ecocide when it comes to environmental destruction of war, which is an interesting discussion because I think it also raises the bar for states and shows the awareness of the consequences of military activities, and they can be held accountable for that. And on a smaller level, ecocide is a very big thing. So we saw the Novakovka Dam explosion in Ukraine as a possible example of that. But the environmental damage is more smaller and widespread on a smaller scale that also needs addressing. And working with affected communities, working with civil society organizations in conflict-affected areas can be a very powerful tool to tell these stories and to engage with states to make sure the funding is available to look at different kind of legal and policy avenues to address this and work towards better protection of civilians and protection of the environment in armed conflict. So I think there's still a long way to go, but I see the pace of our journey is increasing. And we should be ambitious in what we want the end goal to be. And that's something we can dedicate, that we continue to work on together with our partners, but also with international organizations such as the ICRC and others. So it's very welcome to see like this broad journey or broad group of people moving forwards on that journey. And that group of people is only expanding.
Thank you. Quite a lot to look forward there. I like what you said. I mean, of course, our goal should be to prevent wars and not the impact of wars, but at least thinking about the impacts is already something. So quite a lot to look forward there in terms of this discussion developing internationally. Thank you so much. Thanks to both of you for the examples you shared and for your explanations. I hope our listeners will get a lot out of it.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks again, and be good to share and to engage, and looking forward to hear people's responses. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out.
Absolutely. And thanks to PAX for this cooperation. It's a new one for us to do a cooperation podcast like this. So a new, and hopefully we can do this more times in the future.
Yeah, thanks. I also want to thank my colleague, Christina Parandi, who's been working tirelessly to get this all together. So shout out to her as well.
And thanks for inviting us to participate, to both of you.
This was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, today in collaboration with PAX. We will be back with another episode in a few weeks. Follow our latest updates on Twitter under Climate Diplo, and you can also find us on LinkedIn under Climate Diplomacy and Security. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, goodbye.